Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The blue wave in the midterms now even bigger than we thought this time last week. Almost a tsunami, says Nancy Pelosi, who may face a challenge in her bid to become Speaker of the House of Representatives for a second time.
The biggest victory for the Democrats since 1974, when the Watergate babies came in.
Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake threatens to hold up all of President Trump's judicial nominees unless Congress guarantees protections for the Russia investigation of special counsel Robert Mueller.
The attorney general has been fired, and the authority and the oversight for the investigation was taken away from Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and given to someone who has not been Senate confirmed, who has expressed open hostility to the Mueller investigation.
Join us. What do you want from the new Congress? What faith do you have in the nation's new top law enforcement official? Is the president acting decisively or just acting out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With us from Washington, D.C. is Julie Mason. She's host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Julie Mason, longtime friend of mine. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, Dave.
With us also from Washington, D.C. is Ed O'Keefe. He's a CBS News political correspondent. Ed O'Keefe, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Julie, and Ed.
So I wanted to start with a few words from earlier this week. On Monday, Democrats were able to get word that their losses in the Senate were not going to be as bad as they feared, maybe a couple of seats. Arizona Democratic Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema delivered a victory speech out there after beating Republican Congresswoman Martha McSally to become Arizona's first female U.S. senator.
Arizona rejected what has become far too common in our country: name-calling, petty personal attacks, and doing and saying whatever it takes just to get elected. It's dangerous, and it lessens who we are as a country. But Arizona proved that there is a better way forward.
Ed O'Keefe, you cover The Hill, among other things. Now that things are in view, how strong is the Democratic position going to be up on Capitol Hill?
Well, David, as I tweeted last night, Democrats now can literally say they hold seats from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. If you look at the districts that those areas represent in the song, they're blue now. And while they may have some problems in the middle of the country, they picked up seats, remember, in places like Oklahoma and Kansas, made big gains in southern Virginia, parts of the state that are becoming increasingly blue. And so while it may have taken a while to arrive, to hit the beaches, I think it is now fair to say this was a blue wave. Pelosi said this week it's the largest pickup since the Watergate era. That is true. And if you look at where and who won, it is a real reflection of what many Democrats and independents and political observers believe will ultimately become the face of politics in this country. Far more diverse, far more female. And for Democrats, the good news is that it seems to be everywhere, not just confined as it once was to the cities and to the coasts.
And what of the fate of Nancy Pelosi? She seems to have led them to victory, and yet it sounds like on shakier ground than you might have thought.
Well, you know, the other way I compared it this week is, and I think it's still an apt metaphor, you get together every year for your family reunion, and some people grovel that they don't like the way the family reunion is run, but nobody's volunteering to actually run the family reunion. That's kind of the situation that Democrats who don't like Nancy Pelosi are in.
Not a challenger yet on the field.
Exactly. Nobody is stepping up to take that challenge. There's been talk about potential people, but none of them have put forward their name, at least of this discussion. And until or unless they do, this is kind of a silly academic conversation. And Pelosi, to her credit, said it 2 years ago when she was challenged and said it again this time. If somebody wants to step up and try, by all means, go ahead. But nobody has.
You know, it's interesting. The great reporter Alec McGillis, who's looked at Ohio, pointed out these might have been a lot bigger, but for certain kinds of gerrymandering in that state, I think he said something like 12 out of 16 congressional seats went to the Republicans, although they only won 52% of the vote for the congressional vote. And they won supermajorities in both houses of the state house, despite losing the overall state vote to the Democrats on that. Let me ask you, Julie Mason, how is this a Democratic strength going to affect the president in times ahead?
Oh, well, there's about to be a whole lot of pain delivered to the Trump administration. I mean, they're talking about all sorts of oversight, investigations. And speaking of Nancy Pelosi and her leadership, the Democrats could be in a real position to, you know, if they want to dethrone her and put someone new and untested in that position, they could really overplay their hand coming up in the new Congress. Because, you know, if impeach becomes the new repeal and replace, then Democrats are not going to be looking as strong in 2 years in 2020. So they could really use a steady hand at the helm, even though, you know, I think a lot of Democrats would be sympathetic to the idea that, you know, new leadership, younger leadership, more diverse leadership. But it's a real moment for the Democrats, and they could really, as I said, overplay their hand. But things are about to get very miserable, not just for the president, but for his whole administration. And you can feel people in the White House calculating whether this is a good time to go. Are they going to be able to pay their own legal fees if they stick around? How many times are they going to be hauled up before Congress? What are those fights going to look like? It's about to get really rough.
You know, there has been these decided races, but there's a lot of uncertainty in the states of Georgia and Florida, particularly Florida. You think of the Senate and gubernatorial races there. Florida Democratic Senator Bill Nelson has just sued Palm Beach County and the Florida's Secretary of State. And he's been asking for a hand recount of all ballots due to repeated machine failures during the recount. Here's Palm Beach County Election Supervisor Susan Booker.
We gave it everything we had. I'm very proud of my team. I'm proud that we had partners at Palm Beach County, and we are a good election office, and I have a great team. I think that we just got stuck with some mechanical issues that were inherited.
Julie Mason, what's the state of play in Florida?
It's never a good look when you got to go to a hand count. I mean, it's just a mess there. What did some judge said, called the state the laughing stock of the world, which is perhaps overstating it. But still, they're going to review thousands of ballots. They got 67 counties. They've got 3 days to do it. And this is, we're talking about Nelson v. Scott. It's just a mess there. Once again, Florida, I think all of us who covered the recount in 2000 are having sort of like a PTSD moment. Like, I don't want to go back to town. Tallahassee. That was just a mess.
It seems to me as though there's been this interesting thing that we've seen where there's been an echoing of the president's rhetoric in terms of the faith of in votes and that he expressed in 2016. You've seen Governor Scott really weigh in a certain way. What do you guys make of that rhetoric echoing in Florida from what we've seen in Washington, you know, just 2 years ago?
Well, it's very similar, Dave, isn't it? Allegations of fraud, yet no evidence of fraud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's telling that Scott, who I think during the campaign tried to cast himself as sort of a moderate bridge builder, almost immediately went for the jugular, bringing up these unfounded claims. Whereas Ron DeSantis, who campaigned as the partisan warrior to be governor, has now sort of stepped back and is quietly sort of trying to prepare to be governor, knowing that he's probably ultimately going to win, but not bandying about these charges that the outgoing governor is alleging. And it's, you know, it's an interesting situation. I think there's a lot of lessons here to be learned, both for the state of Florida and other states, but also for the Democratic Party. These are races that they probably could have won. And mm-hmm. Something went wrong yet again for them there. And it's hard to believe that Democrats haven't learned the lessons of the last few elections. And even more dumbfounding that state election officials, county election officials, still haven't sorted this out. And we could hope that if 2000 didn't do it, maybe this will, and the state can somehow move on. But as a federal judge said on Thursday, they are really the laughingstock of the country for continuing to have these kinds of problems.
Yeah, all echoes of David, 2000. I was going to say, Jack, I wanted, you know, to point out the president weighed in to kind of undermine essentially faith in the vote, saying that he felt that there was voter fraud being committed there once more, not only without evidence, but seemingly baseless claims. What do you make of the president's entry into this?
Well, of course, this is an attack on the pillars of democracy. It was shameless. It was demagogic. And it followed a campaign in which, in 1 month, according to one tally, he repeated he used 817, quote, falsehoods, and the sorts of charges he was making about Florida and, in an interview this week, about California, illegals voting, do nothing but undermine faith in the democratic process. And it sets up, of course, the fearsome prospect that the president, if defeated in the next election, presidential election, may cry foul and take us in the direction that would be unprecedented in American history. If I may, I'd just like to return to this Nancy Pelosi point. 1974, she says. Yes, that was a big year for the Democrats, the Watergate babies. It was also the time when the Democratic Party turned from being a party that was about labor and, you know, bread and butter issues to a process party, a party about, you know, post-Watergate reforms and so on. And economically, the party became more and more conservative because it represented increasingly suburban, more affluent districts. In the last election, just now, 20 of the most, the Democrats took 20 of the most affluent districts in the country. That's great for them. But the Democratic Party is both a political party and a social justice protest movement, at least part of it. And its coalition is made up of people who are poor. And now it has lots and lots of voters who are not poor and who are going to create problems with the Democrats articulating their program. If, therefore, or any sort of redistribution, this is going to really create problems. You know, the new Democrats are going to say, wait a minute, our people aren't going to pay any more taxes to deal with these social justice issues. It creates a real strain with the Democrats, and it is the predicate of what was called the new politics of inequality in the 70s.
And we're going to take it right there for our first break. That you've heard the voice of Jack Beatty, our own news analyst here, also from Julie Mason of SiriusXM's POTUS channel, and Ed O'Keefe, political correspondent for CBS News. We're talking about this week's biggest stories. There are a lot of them. We want you to join the conversation. What do you make of President Trump's behavior in France during the World War I observances? What about the First Lady wading into White House personnel matters? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a not-so-random walk through this week in the news. You can join the conversation. Did President Trump have a terrible, horrible, no-good, very bad week? Or are you tired of all the winning? Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Julie Mason, host of SiriusXM's The Press Pool, Ed O'Keefe, political correspondent for CBS News, and On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. I want to quickly head to the phones. We've got a call from West Orange, New Jersey. Brent, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, Brent.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to first disagree with Jack Beatty. I live in a House district that was flipped here in New Jersey. Mikey Shirelli replaced Rodney Frelinghuysen. And this is a fairly wealthy area, and I don't believe there's any daylight between the different demographic groups financially on wanting things like universal health insurance. Pardon me, I just jumped off my treadmill. So I think that's something that we...
We're all on it here.
Definitely, yes. I think that's something that we definitely all want. And it's not about a redistribution of taxes. It's about spending the money that the government already collects properly. But I also want to say, and that's, I just wanted to get that out because of what Jack Beatty stated.
Sure.
But I also want to say, I just heard Steny Hoyer on NPR a couple of moments before your show came on, and I was terribly disappointed. And it is time for him and Nancy Pelosi to go. I'm going to be calling my newly elected congresswoman and telling her that I want those two gone. He basically capitulated to Trump and basically sold us out on Medicare for all, which is the beginning of a universal health insurance coverage. And it really, truly sickens me.
Okay, Brent, thank you for your call. Steny Hoyer, of course, the number two Democrat in the House of Representatives from Maryland, looks to be the next House Majority Leader. Jack Beatty, your thoughts?
Well, I very much appreciate the call from Brent. You know, it is interesting, isn't it, that the places where the Democrats did the most dramatic change, Orange County, California, now all Democrats representing it. I think there are four, I don't know how many. And then in New Jersey, five, thank you. And then in New Jersey, where you had a big turnover as well, what do those states have in common? They were both hurt by the Republican tax bill that limited the deduction for state and local, especially real estate taxes, to $10,000. That was, in other words, it was tax sensitivity to what you could almost argue was a kind of progressive turn in the Republican bill, saying, you know, we're going to limit the deduction for high income for expensive homes, and that's where the Democrats did dramatically better, making my point. It seems to me that about the tax sensitivity of these new districts that the Democrats represent.
It's interesting. I'm from Orange County, where, if I recall correctly, Ronald Reagan launched his reelection campaign in 1984. Ed O'Keefe, briefly, you think this hinged on taxes?
That was part of it. Also, these are areas of the state of California that voted for Hillary Clinton. And so Democrats saw a ripe opportunity to move in there and try to pick off those seats. They even opened a West Coast office of what's called the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, based it right there in Irvine, California, in the heart of Orange County, and methodically focused on picking off those districts. And it looks like when all is said and done, they will have done it. And real quick, Jack, you made the point about Democrats representing the five or the wealthiest parts of the country. They also represent four of the five poorest districts in the country, in the Bronx, in Detroit, in Mississippi, in Alabama. The only other one they don't represent is in Kentucky. It's held by a Republican. So they really run the economic spectrum now. And I think, more than anything, it'll make it difficult for them to talk about economic issues and make sure somehow that whatever that message is acceptable enough to guys like Brent, who jumped off the treadmill, and folks who live in these other districts across the country.
Well, it sets up the impending conflict within the Democratic Party, doesn't it? And caller Brent raises a really important point. Are they going to go in the direction that progressives want them to and risk losing their power, or are they going to stay with the safe old pragmatists of the party and do what's safe?
Such a good point. It actually leads us to thinking about that very question, the tensions among voters on the Democratic side, the liberal side, who want action. A lot of people are thinking hard about the Mueller investigation. Bob Mueller's the special counsel who's investigating all these issues around Trump world and around the question of connection with Russian 2016 election. On Wednesday, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake threatened to vote against all of President Trump's judicial nominees, his own party, if legislation to protect special counsel Robert Mueller doesn't receive a floor vote on the Senate.
We've needed to move these judges through, but this is priority now. The justification given in April for not bringing it to a floor vote was that nobody was being fired. There's nothing to see here. Special counsel Mueller was not in any danger. That clearly is not the case now. Attorney General has been fired, and the authority and the oversight for the investigation was taken away from Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, and given to someone who has not been Senate confirmed, who has expressed open hostility to the Mueller investigation.
On the same day, during a press conference with Flake, Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware questioned Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker's legal ideas, his experience for the position, and even the constitutionality of his appointment. And then Coons said there's even a bigger problem.
The larger issue that concerns me and that I think concerns my friend Senator Flake is public statements made a year ago by Matthew Whitaker, now the Acting Attorney General of the United States, questioning the validity and the conduct of the special counsel's investigation.
Julie Mason, how much peril is Robert Mueller's investigation in?
That depends. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and others have been saying there's no need to protect the investigation. We see no evidence that the Trump administration is going to do anything to dismantle the probe at all. But, you know, assurances from the administration have been proven over and over again worthless. Whitaker seems like a menace to the Mueller investigation, and Trump himself has been like tweet storming about it this week and seems to be brooding. There's reporting he's been meeting with his lawyers in a very cross mood about the whole thing. It seems like a very perilous moment for the Mueller investigation.
Julie, you covered Congress and the White House for years. We met a couple decades ago, I think, when you first started doing that. You know, mm-hmm. How would these actions be taken in previous administrations? That is, you know, to what extent is even the appointment of the acting attorney general, could that be interpreted as a way of interfering with the investigation?
Yeah, it could. But you think previous administrations would not have made such a boneheaded move as putting a chief of staff in as acting attorney general. The logical move, the sort of legal move would have been to put Rosenstein in as acting attorney general until you get a nominee or until you nominate Rosenstein. And the Whitaker thing blew up in the administration's face so fast, so hard that it's almost not comparable to anything like Bush would have done or Clinton would have done or Obama would have done, because I just don't think they would have done that.
Mm-hmm. Ed O'Keefe, you know, the president's facing this blue wave we've discussed. He's thinking hard about when the next shoe is going to drop or the next store of shoes are going to drop in the Mueller investigation. We've also seen the president acting out and acting intensely, shall we say, this week. Let's start with what happened a little bit. He had a tirade against Mueller on Twitter, and he also had this behavior that we saw in Europe. Tell us about what happened with the president when he was in France and what he did and what he did not do over there.
Well, what he didn't do last Saturday was visit a cemetery that was where is the final resting place of essentially American veterans who served in World War I. The White House announced he wouldn't be going because the chopper ride he was going to take was clouded in, fogged in. And then they claimed that he couldn't motorcade out to the facility or to the cemetery because it would tie up traffic. And so he essentially, as we understand it, sat at the ambassador's residence in Paris and really didn't do much of anything that day. Sunday, there were bigger events, a parade, a military review, a speech by the French president and some other meetings he had. But he really got called out by the French president Macron, who made the argument that nationalism flies in the face of patriotism, which was not only directed at Trump, but also the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, who was in attendance. And so I think a lot of people wonder, what was the point of that trip if you weren't there to pay reverence to American military veterans? And, it just sort of fed this idea that in the days after the election, he was brooding. He's concerned about what happens to him legally and politically in the coming months. Mm-hmm. And he just seemed off his game.
I want to take a call now. Hold on 1 second, Julie. I just want to take a call from Akron, Ohio about this very, very topic. Leo, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, David. Bad enough that Trump was the lone head of state to not make it to the cemetery in France. He didn't even get himself to Arlington National Cemetery on Veterans Day. Now, mm-hmm. What does that tell you about this man's priorities and his character?
Thanks so much.
It all.
Thanks so much, Leo. Julie Mason, what does it say about the president's priorities this week?
Well, Veterans Day is for living veterans. It's not really a cemetery holiday. It can be. A better move maybe would have been to go to Walter Reed. That's sort of the traditional Veterans Day stop for presidents and meet privately with wounded veterans, some people who are undergoing treatment there. That would have been the move. He didn't want to do that. He just seems in a petulant snit that ever since, I guess the midterm. So it didn't really surprise me, but yeah, it does, especially given his rhetoric about how much he's doing for veterans and how his administration and all this, it puts it in a different light.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, you and I were talking before the show, and you said you were struck a little bit by coverage in multiple outlets that seemed to add up in your mind to a question about the president's state of being at the moment. What do you mean by that?
Well, there have just been stories. The Washington Post, 5 days of fury, their headline. Vanity Fair, summarizing people in what Republicans have told the author, insanity at a new level. The Los Angeles Times seeing a, quote, cocoon of bitterness. And this to explain the president's seeming retreat on Veterans Day. There was a meeting with King Hussein, I believe, that was scheduled. I don't know whether it was scheduled or not, but he didn't meet with the president. And there were several other canceled appointments, I believe. And it led to the sense of this brooding, angry president who was lashing out, blaming people for almost anybody for losing the election. And I think really that's crucial here. I mean, the president had to face what happened. He lost that election. It was the failure of his political strategy to demagogue on the caravan to make that polarization on sort of racial ethnic lines to make that division. It's that shamed so many Republican voters in suburbs who just couldn't go along with it. And the president, for the first time, had to face the fact that his political instincts, which he's always praising himself on, were wrong. He was just wrong. And one poll shows, I think it was a Monmouth poll, that only 38% want him reelected. Well, that'll change, but that's brought home just the dimension of this failure.
Mm-hmm. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point. You know, as you say, Jack, the caravan mentions, fell off the table. Fox News can often be a pretty good surrogate as well as advocate for the president. I think mentions were less than a fifth of the caravan in the week following elections than they were in the week before the elections. That is, it dropped off by more than 80%, which gets you a feel for whether or not there is from Washington a sense of crisis on this on the Republican side. So too, there were these talks the president engaged in terms of middle class tax cut, which seemed to completely disappear. Ed O'Keefe, I also wanted to turn to an element that's playing out here. One of our listeners on Facebook, Karen Dillon, writes, the Trumps are still playing the apprentice game. So the president has talked about replacing cabinet secretaries, right? We've heard about the possibility John Kelly, the chief of staff, could be moved out. We've also been hearing about the Department of Homeland Security and perhaps others after the attorney general. What's the state of play on that?
State of play is he hasn't done anything except boot the attorney general, Jeff Sessions, and we'll see whether or not anybody else goes. Remember, it's not only the president that plays this game, but a lot of staffers and senior administration officials are totally actively participating in it as well by feeding reporters, you know, their line of thinking or their hopes about where things will land. There's talk of at least, if I counted up, four other cabinet secretaries who are on the bubble. The Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross. You mentioned the Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen. The Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke. The Defense Secretary, James Mattis. Now, Secretary Mattis, has signaled he's not going anywhere. And, you know, the president would have to have good cause to get rid of him because he's got friends on both sides of the aisle. The others are likely to go at some point, either due to just general fatigue or the fact that the president doesn't like them. And remember, turnover in any administration is normal. And ahead of what is expected to be a contentious reelection campaign, the administration may want to clear house of some of what they consider to be dead weight. That's totally justifiable in any presidency. What's different about this one, of course, is that the conversation about it and the threat of somebody being removed is so much more apparent and frequent. And often the person who's targeted may only learn about it through a tweet. So, you know, we have to keep an eye on the Twitter handle, especially on Fridays and weekends when the president has a tendency to make news. We have to presume that there will be turnover. But also we have to remember he's going to have to consult with the Senate about how much time they really want to spend on what Mitch McConnell calls the personnel business next year. Because if he clears out three or four major cabinet secretaries and is still pushing to have dozens of federal judges confirmed in a Republican-controlled Senate, then they're not going to get much more done because those have the potential to eat up months of floor time and certainly a lot of the just general political discussion up there if he's nominating people who may not be palatable to both sides, or at least not to a majority of Republicans and a handful of Democrats who could help potentially get some of those people confirmed.
Julie Mason, we got about a minute before the break. I wanted to ask you this. The First Lady sort of sparked a bunch of wide-eyed emojis around the country when her spokeswoman weighed in and said that she no longer had faith in the ability, I think it's of the Deputy National Security Advisor, to play a constructive role in the administration. She was shortly after shifted to a new job, that is, this aide. What do you make of Melania Trump weighing in on that?
Wow, amazing. All right. So this deputy national security advisor had gotten crossways with Mrs. Trump on her trip abroad to Africa that she recently took. And the lesson to take away is do not get in a knife fight with the First Lady because she will cut you and take you out of your job.
Folks, we're talking rhetorically here. This is all metaphoric, but it seems as though, you know, usually these knives get drawn behind the scenes very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, Hillary Clinton, very big advisor on policy when she was First Lady. Is this really so different?
It's a little different. Yeah, it's a little different. This is not a First Lady who's involved in policy, but she's now getting involved in personnel.
There you go. You can join our conversation about the stories this past week. Big headlines making news right now. A federal judge hands a win to CNN over the president and the White House and the push for the press pass. We'll be talking about that. We'll also be talking about a couple tech giants in the news. Amazon might not have picked your city for HQ. Does that mean you won or lost? What about allegations Facebook didn't do enough about fake news and sought to discredit its competitors and critics rather than address the problem? We want our guests to stick around. We want you to stick around. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We pause for a moment to note the death of the screenwriter William Goldman. He was best known for his Academy Award-winning screenplays for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and also famously All the President's Men. He also endeared himself to generations with his book and then his screen adaptation of The Princess Bride. He was 87 years old. We also wanted to acknowledge what's been happening in California. More than 60 people are confirmed dead due to campfire in Northern California. Hundreds are still missing. Smoke spreading across the state is sparking health concerns. And here's San Francisco resident Daniel Horn.
It just feels very smoky and full of particulates. And I'm definitely worried about my son who's breathing this stuff.
You can join our conversation. What caught your eye this week? What are you watching for in the coming days? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Ed O'Keefe, political correspondent, CBS News, Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM, and of course, our very own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Julie Mason, you host The Press Pool. We have just gotten word that federal judge Timothy Kelly, nominated by President Trump and confirmed by the Senate on a 94-2 vote last year, has ruled in favor of CNN and its chief White House correspondent Jim Acosta and against the White House. It has ordered that the White House must immediately restore Jim Acosta's hard press pass. Tell us what that means and tell us why that matters.
Well, it was a really tough moment when the administration pulled Jim Acosta's hard pass. It was not his press credential. It allows you access in and out of the White House, and it's something you really need as a White House correspondent. And it to the press corps, it seemed arbitrary. It seemed vindictive and petty, and also a terrible precedent, which the president doubled down on by saying that he was thinking about pulling some more if things got a little, you know, not to his liking. And I think all of us in the press corps really wanted this resolved quickly. And it's not surprising. It seemed like the law was on the side of the press on this one. And I just hope that we can move on, because these spats between the administration and the press corps don't serve anyone. As Marty Baron at The Washington Post has said, and I think a lot of us have taken this on, is that we are not at war. We are at work. And we shouldn't be feuding with the president and having these fights. So hopefully this is the end of it.
It sort of raises two questions, right? One question is whether there is something to the idea that the press, in the person of somebody like Jim Acosta, who isn't only going to work, he's going in a kind of rhetorical combat, whereas there's sort of a performative element where you can see the press engaging in that tension with public officials and particularly the president. And the second question is, what kind of journalism emerges from that briefing room? I mean, what is the value to that as opposed to just saying to reporters, you know, you guys should scatter and do enterprise work that these guys don't want to talk about in public?
Well, and any time you engage the president directly, which this president, like him or hate him, interacts with reporters far more often than his predecessors, the briefings, that's a harder argument to make these days, because we have a situation where it can get quite contentious, and therefore the ability to obtain information or at least a formal no comment can get tripped up. There are moments in there where we do learn information from the administration about policy, about personnel decisions, about scheduling issues that they don't otherwise announce or wouldn't announce as publicly. And there are opportunities there to at least get official comment from the administration on certain things. In previous administrations, it might lead to follow-up from the press office later on, if something is asked and they didn't have an answer and they clarify it later. In this administration,
it hasn't
necessarily been that way. Right.
Right. Jack Beatty, does this validate the press in the public eye, or is this just a legal win?
I think probably just a legal win. And I'm all in favor of it. I'm glad it happened. At the same time, I have noted that there's been a kind of undertone of criticism of Jim Acosta by some of his colleagues in the press corps about his italicizing his moments with his back, you know, with Sarah Sanders, and making them big. And he does have a histrionic streak, and some of the reporters resent it and feel that he's not the best face of the Washington press corps.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yet it was notable the degree to which both his colleagues in the press room supported him, and also a number of news organizations, including Fox News, supported him illegally. I want to hop over for a moment, Jack Beatty, the pond to Great Britain, where an event has happened with some degree of importance for the future of Europe and the future of the UK and the future of Prime Minister Theresa May. She's been pushing the idea of Brexit, and she's trying to push Parliament into supporting her plan for it. It's a little wobbly at the moment. On Thursday, she spoke to Parliament about Wednesday's Brexit negotiations.
What we agreed yesterday was not the final deal. It is a draft treaty. It is a draft treaty that means that we will leave the EU in a smooth and orderly way on the 29th of March 2019. And which sets the framework for a future relationship that delivers in our national interest.
Jack Beatty, remind us just a little bit what's at stake and a little bit of how likely it appears that this is going to happen.
It looks bad on whether it's going to happen. The coalition against is so broad. You could see it really in the Johnson family. There is Boris Johnson, the demagogic remainer who quit the cabinet last year. He's against it. I mean, he's a Brexiteer. And then there's his brother Joe, who's a remainer. He quit the cabinet this week. So there you are. The can't please the remainers, can't please the Brexiteers in this in this deal. The Labour Party, at least its leadership, is against it. The Scottish Party is against it. The DUP from Northern Ireland, on which the governing coalition depends, they're against the deal. Liberals are against it. And there's a movement among the Conservatives to essentially remove a vote of no confidence in Theresa May, this hard core of Conservatives. And if they get to 43 in this cabal, they can do that. So it looks very bad for her. As to how they got here, well, that would, you know, you could go on like the brook forever about that one. But, you know, and it's far be it from an American in the age of Trump to comment on the irrationality of other people's politics.
But that was kind of their Trump moment, right? The Brexit vote.
Yes, indeed. And it looks, the more you look at it, the more wounding and self-wounding It is. I mean, Boris Johnson claimed that there'd be this big return of funds from the EU to the national health. In fact, the British are going to have to pay a ransom, a divorce settlement of about $40 billion to get out of the EU.
That's right.
And people have spoken about a revote. Let's do this again. Even as some people on the Brexit side have mentioned this, the people in the Labour Party have mentioned it. And by the way, the Labour Party, led by this really demagogic Jeremy Corbyn, who is against, he's for Brexit because that's what he thinks the people want. But he had a moment there where he could have been for the country, which would have been to deliver some kind of deal. And you know, his is supposed to be the cosmopolitan party defending Europe and so on. Very disturbing. I've seen people who expect more from the Labour Party.
Well, so you're seeing a sort of a unifying theme in the terms of a lot of distrust of institutions, including politicians on both sides, but also including major social media outfits like Facebook. And one of the reasons that there's a tie there, of course, is that Facebook, both during Brexit and in the 2016 elections and fears now, really didn't do enough to recognize and register the degree to which there was false information, disinformation intentionally spread by bad actors on its platform. We have a call now about this subject from Londonderry, New Hampshire. Louisa Pietti, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Louisa, go ahead.
Hi, it's Piet. Thank you so much for taking my call. And
yes, ma'am.
I apologize for a cat meowing. I'm at the vet.
We take listeners of all species and kinds.
Well, I am calling just to say that I'm extremely disappointed with Facebook. Facebook has not done near enough to protect our democracy. I was a candidate here in New Hampshire for state rep. Unfortunately, I did not make it. But Facebook allowed lies made out about me by the Londonderry Republican Committee, making up an allegation that I never made, and they have no proof. And they ran an ad that reached thousands and thousands of voters just a few days before election. And I contacted Facebook. A lot of people contacted Facebook. There's a functionality that says this is fake news or harassment. Everybody that I know did that on my behalf. Facebook did not take the ad down. And in fact, if you go to their page, it's still there. And it's all completely made up news. So I can only imagine that this has been happening throughout the country. And what a sad day it was for me to have been victimized. I was a victim of death threats. I had to be escorted by the police to go vote. My town had to have an extra 12 policemen at the polling station because of the death threat. And this is all because of Facebook not taking down an ad that was fake. Anyway, I take my comments off the air from
now on. And thank you for sharing your experience, Louisa. What a story. You know, this week there was also a remarkable deep dive in the New York Times about Facebook, about its failure to take adequate steps to protect against the distribution of not just wrong information, but intentional misinformation, distortions, and that Facebook then took actions to essentially go after and deflect criticism to focus it on Facebook's competitors and Facebook's critics as though it was sort of a political actor. On Thursday, there was a conference call with reporters. Facebook chief executive and chairman Mark Zuckerberg, trying to quell the firestorm, defended his company, denying the allegations in the Times that he had helped to organize a strategy to deny, deflect, and minimize many of the problems at the social media giant.
To suggest that we weren't interested in knowing the truth, or that we wanted to hide what we knew, or that we tried to prevent investigations, is simply untrue.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Ed O'Keefe, on Capitol Hill, how much appetite is there for diving back into the question of whether or not these social media platforms should be more highly regulated?
Oh, there's an appetite, and not only on Capitol Hill, but among the lobbyists here in Washington who work for them, because their asking price might go up. This latest New York Times report sparked at least some, especially Democratic members, to ask questions about what needs to be done, whether the Justice Department's looking into any of this. They'll raise questions of antitrust policy and whether Facebook is you know, ripe for regulation. I think House Democrats, especially once they get control of committees next year, will certainly make it a topic of discussion. Look, it's something from everyone who, like your listener at the Vet in New Hampshire, to us, to others, to billions around the world. It is a relevant conversation now, just much like getting the mail. You know, social media and what is said and done on there has a direct effect on a lot of people and their lifestyle. And so it's an easy subject to sort of generate conversation on. Whether there will ever be concrete policy, however, I think remains to be seen, in part because, you know, all of this has sort of been caught up in the 2016 who interfered in what conversations. And so it's a tricky political issue.
Part of the problem, Dave, is that Facebook is not a news organization. You know, we heard the caller saying it was fake news, what they were putting out. Well, they're not a news organization. So, but what are their responsibilities? That's a big question.
Well, it's that tension between are you a publisher or are you a platform like, you know, AT&T or Verizon? And they've kind of conceded they can no longer simply be thought of as a platform, even as they're fighting furiously to be not regulated in the way that platforms are. You know, flipping the coin a little bit in the social media world and going from Facebook and thinking about Amazon, you know, there was a place where dozens of cities across the country vied for the opportunity to get what was called HQ2, this new Amazon second headquarters, and total giveaways being offered. The winners were split, as we now know, between suburban Virginia outside D.C. and here in New York City. In an interview with MSNBC's Morning Joe on Wednesday, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio discussed Amazon's choice to locate its second headquarters here in Queens, explaining that he drove what he called a hard bargain.
We have a strong social fabric, a sense of fairness that we're creating in the city, and an incredible workforce and a diverse workforce. That's what attracted Amazon. Amazon wanted a whole host of different types of subsidies and concessions. We wouldn't give it to them. What we got in the end was a 9-to-1 ratio of the amount of revenue we're going to get back for any kind of incentives that they got.
Julie Mason, here in New York, the city was basically mass transit incapacitated yesterday by well-predicted and relatively mild snowstorm. D.C., I understand traffic was badly snarled as well. How much of a win is it to get this many to give away as much money as was given away and to get this many complications to logistics in return?
Right. Well, Dave, that's the thing. This process with these giveaways to these corporations to relocate. You look at the example of what happened in Seattle after Amazon put their big HQ there. Spiraling homelessness, rising rents, people priced out of buying a home in their community. I guess it's a potentially a windfall for the city. They act like it's a panacea, but to me, it's like getting the Olympics. You know, you build all these facilities, they come, and then it's over, and then you're stuck. And when it's all done, you can't really remember what benefit you got from it. I guess we'll see. I mean, Amazon seemed aware of that when they sort of split the baby and put half in New York and half here in the Virginia suburbs. But, you know, it's hard to see how it benefits the people who live here. You mentioned mass transit and the problems in New York. Of course, Metro here is a mess, too. The reason traffic was snarled was because no one takes the Metro anymore.
That's the voice of Julie Mason. She's host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Julie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave. You're the best.
Appreciate it. Ed O'Keefe, man. Political correspondent for CBS News. We appreciate your time, too.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Always glad to have you with us on Fridays.
Thank you, Dave.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo, Barkley Palmer, and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up Monday, President Trump throws his support behind a rewrite of federal sentencing laws. We'll examine a moment when politicians from both sides of the aisle join in a push for criminal justice reform. Today on Folk and Flick Fridays, I'm David Folk and Flick, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.